Lowry has identified the only interconnectedness a significant chunk of Islam is interested in. Islamism is a 21st century political project driven by 7th century ideology. That's a potent combination of ancient and modern. In Europe and North America, incendiary imams, uneducated and knowing barely a word of the language spoken by the society in which they live, have nevertheless done a grand job at reprimitivizing second and third generation Western Muslims. Not all of them, of course, but how many does it have to become a problem? There are three strategies Islam deploys against a dying West. First, demography. Second, conversion. And third, the murky intertwining of modern technology and ancient hatreds. For example, I hadn't really followed Sudanese current events closely since, General Kitchener's victory at the Battle of Omdurman in 1898. But in 2003, a story from that benighted land happened to catch my eye. In the fall of that year, mass hysteria apparently swept the capital city, Khartoum, after reports that foreigners were shaking hands with Sudanese men and causing their penises to disappear. One victim, a fabric merchant, told his story to the London Arabic newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi. A man from West Africa came into the shop and shook the store owner's hand powerfully until the owner felt his penis melt into his body. I know the feeling. The same thing happened to me after shaking hands with Senator Clinton. Anyway, as Al-Quds reported, the store owner became hysterical and was taken to the hospital. The country's chief criminal attorney general, Yasser Ahmad Mohammed, told the Sudanese daily Al-Ray Al-Am that the rumor broke out when one merchant went to another merchant to buy some karkadeh, a Sudanese beverage. Suddenly, the seller felt his penis shriveling. The invaluable Middle East Media Research Institute, in its exhaustive coverage, noted that the penises of Khartoum were vulnerable not merely to handshaking. Another victim, who refused to give his name, said that while he was at the market, a man approached him, gave him a comb, and asked him to comb his hair. When he did so, within seconds, he said, he felt a strange sensation and discovered that he had lost his penis. Tales of the vanishing penises ran rampant through the city. Sudan's attorney general, Salah Abu Zayed, declared that all complaints about missing dangly bits would be brought before a special investigative committee, though doctors had determined that the first plaintiff was perfectly healthy. The health minister, Ahmad Bilal Uthman, said that the epidemic was scientifically groundless, and that it was sorcery, magic, or an emotional problem. Whatever it is, it's the perfect tale of Islamic victimhood. The foreigners have made us impotent. It doesn't matter that the foreigners didn't do anything except shake hands. It doesn't matter whether you are, in fact, impotent. You feel impotent, just as, so we're told constantly, millions of Muslims, from Algerian Islamists to the Bali bombers on the other side of the world, feel humiliated by the Palestinian situation. Whether there is a rational basis for their sense of humiliation or impotence is irrelevant. But here's the telling detail. The vanishing penis hysteria was spread by cell phones and text messaging. Think about that. You can own a cell phone, yet still believe that shaking hands with an infidel will cause you to lose your penis. That's a state-of-the-art primitive. Aside from its doubts in its collective manhood, Sudan is no laughing matter. 2 million people were slaughtered there in the 90s. That's one-third of the victims of the Holocaust, and the world barely noticed. So much for never again. The Christian minority is vanishing a lot faster than that fabric merchant's privates. Among the, non-Christian majority, Osama certainly found the country fertile ground for his ideology. Sudanese mujahideen have been captured as far afield as Algeria, Bosnia, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. Sudan is an economic basket case with a 27% literacy rate that nevertheless has managed to find enough spare cash to export revolutionary Islam to many other countries. And they've got $500 million worth of top Chinese weaponry imported via Iran. What else might Sudan get from Tehran in the years ahead? In April 2006, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, announced that his government was ready to share its nuclear technology with other interested parties. Iran's nuclear capability is one example of various scientific capabilities in the country, said the Ayatollah. The Islamic Republic of Iran is prepared to transfer the experience, knowledge, and technology of its scientists. He made this offer at a meeting with the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. A handshake-fearing guy with a cell phone is one thing. What happens when the handshake-fearers have cell phones and a suitcase nuke? It's at the meeting of apparently indestructible ancient ignorance and cheap, widely available modern technology that the dark imponderables of the future lie. America Alone by Mark Stein. Continued. Disc 7. How far does that techno-primitive hybrid reach? In 2004, there was another story about cell phones in the paper, not Khartoum this time. The Times of London reported that mobile phones are being used by young Muslims living in Britain to watch videos of hostages being beheaded by militants in Iraq. This is the best use of this phone, the paper was told by an Algerian in his 30s who has lived in London for almost 10 years. And has collected the entire set of snuff videos on his cell. Most of the people in this country are using it to download pictures of naked women. For us, the jihad is alive in our hands as we watch American infidels get their heads chopped off. Within a few minutes of the Americans dying last week, I was watching them on my phone. The Englishman should not have been there, he added, referring to then-hostage Ken Bigley. He will be beheaded. And I can tell you I will see it here on my phone. He was, and that Muslim Londoner undoubtedly did. In 1898, after Kitchener slaughtered the dervishes at Omdurman, Hilaire Belloc wrote a characteristically pithy summation of the British technological advantage. Whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun. And they have not. But the dervishes have cell phones now, and there are plenty of people out there willing to help them get cheap knockoffs of the 21st century's Maxim gun. And, Maxim guns aside, we're bound by Maxims of Prudence, in Kant's phrase, and they're not. As Lee Harris wrote, the liberal world system has collapsed internally. We no longer know the limits of behavior. When the president of Iran threatens to wipe Israel off the face of the map, we cannot reliably assure ourselves that this is just a bit of rhetorical red meat, a little playing to the gallery for the Saturday night jihad crowd. Nonetheless, many foolish experts do. We persist in seeing Iran's president Ahmadinejad as the equivalent of the Sudanese crazy raving about his vanished manhood. Except that in this case, he's raving about having no dong, which, like a nuclear Kmart, Kim Jong-il is happily dispersing around the planet. One could foresee certain problems if the president of Sudan goes on TV and announces, I am proud to tell the people I have no dong. Oh no, the epidemic spread to the palace. Mass panic, etc. Confronted by the minimal degrees of separation between the loonies and many of their leaders, we look away and pretend that President Ahmadinejad is no different from the Politburo of yore. The Reds could have nuked us, but they had compelling reasons not to. They had the capability, but we were able to make a rational assessment of their intent by considering what we would do in their situation. It's the other way around with Iran. They have the intent, and the only question mark is over their capability. President Amadometry is the globalized version of those Khartoum men who own cell phones and yet believe a handshake can make one's manhood disappear. He owns nukes, and he believes he can make the West's manhood disappear. Indeed, his wish to obliterate Israel is one of his less nutty aspects. That can be seen as a slightly overheated version of politics as usual in the Middle East. What's more significant is that he believes in the return of the 12th Imam, the so-called hidden Imam, and quite possibly that he personally is the fellow's designated deputy. The president, as mayor of Tehran, wanted the city's boulevards widened so that the hidden Imam wouldn't be insulted by having to ride in triumph through narrow streets. He's also claimed that when he addressed the United Nations General Assembly in 2005, a mystical halo appeared and bathed him in its aura. It wasn't the exit sign, or if it was, it didn't endow the Prime Minister of Canada with any similar beatific aura. Shortly afterwards, he told Natwar Singh, the Indian foreign minister, that everything would be hunky-dory in 2 years' time, which Mr. Singh took to mean when Iran's nukes would be ready, but which turned out to be the 12th Imam's ETA. Human history has never wanted for millennial cultists of one form or another, but ours is the first age in which such men have the means to pull off the apocalypse. In medieval Europe, the apocalyptics had intent. President Amagednata here is an apocalyptic with a delivery system. The end is nigh is an old slogan. Now, the means are nigh. The Look. One of the most enduring vignettes of the Great War comes from its first Christmas, December 1914. The Germans and British, separated by a few yards of mud on the Western Front, put up banners to wish each other season's greetings, sang Silent Night in the Dark in both languages, and eventually scrambled up from their opposing trenches to play a Christmas Day football match in no man's land and share some German beer and English plum jam. After this Yuletide interlude, they went back to killing each other. The many films, books, and plays inspired by that no man's land truce all take for granted the story's central truth, that our common humanity transcends the temporary hell of war. When the politicians and generals have done with us, those who are left will live in peace, playing footy, that is, soccer, singing songs, as they did for a moment in the midst of carnage. Now cross to Israel, to Haifa, on a Saturday night in 2003. 19 diners were killed in a packed restaurant by a 20-something female suicide bomber, her hair attractively tied in a Western-style ponytail, to judge from the detached head she left as her calling card. Try to find the common humanity between the participants in that war. Try to imagine the two sides ever kicking a ball around, swapping songs. The only place in the modern Middle East where Arabs and Jews coexist is in Israel, especially in Haifa. The restaurant young Hanadi Jaradat blew apart had been jointly owned by an Arab family and a Jewish family for 40 years. It would be interesting to know whether it was targeted for that very reason, in the same way that, in Northern Ireland, the IRA took to killing the Catholic caterers and cleaners who worked at army bases. But the Intifada is too primal for anything that thought out. It's more likely that once Miss Jaradat had slipped into Israel proper, through a gap in the unfinished security fence the European Union and the State Department so deplore, she decided that any target would do. She was busting to blow. The Palestinian death cult negates all the assumptions of Western sentimental pacifism, not least that war is a board game played by old men, with young men as their chess pieces. If only the vengeful, aged generals got out of the way, there'd be no conflict. But such common humanity as one can find on the West Bank resides, if only in their cynicism, in the leadership. Old Arafat may have showered glory and honor on his youthful martyrs, but he was human enough to keep his own kid in Paris, well away from the suicide bomber belts. It's hard to picture Saab Erekat or Hanan Ashrawi or any of the other veteran terror apologists who hog the airwaves at CNN and the BBC celebrating the deaths of their loved ones the way Miss Gerardot's brother did. "We are receiving congratulations from people," said Thaher Gerardot. "Why should we cry? It is like her wedding day, the happiest day for her." The problem is not the security fence, but the psychological fence, a chasm, really, that separates a sizable proportion of the Palestinian population from all Jews. For one side, there is no common humanity, even with people they know well, who provide them with jobs and much else. Wafa Samir Ibrahim Albis, a 21-year-old woman who has received kind and exemplary treatment at an Israeli hospital in Beersheba, packs herself with explosives and sets off to blow apart that hospital and the doctors and nurses who've treated her. Oh, well, if you're pro-Palestinian, you shrug that their depravity is born of desperation. If you've had it with the Palestinians, you figure that after decades of UN coddling and EU funding and wily Arab manipulation, they're the most comprehensively wrecked people on the planet. In either case, it's a very particular circumstance. But what if that desperation goes global? What if it's shared by large numbers of other people around the planet? Here's another death scene. Photographed from above, the body bags look empty. They seem to lie flat on the ground, and it's only when you peer closer that you realize that that's because the bodies in them are too small to fill the length of the bags. They're children, row upon row of dead children, over 100 of them, 150, more, many of them shot in the back as they tried to flee. It was a picture from the Beslan massacre, the pupils of a Russian schoolhouse taken hostage and slaughtered in September 2004. And, as Ken Bigley did, the very last thing they heard as they departed this world was the voice of their killer screaming, "Allahu Akbar." God is great. This virus has been a long time incubating. In 1971, in the lobby of the Cairo Sheraton, terrorists shot the Prime Minister of Jordan at point-blank range. As he fell to the floor dying, one of his killers began drinking the blood gushing from his wounds. 35 years later, the Palestinian Authority elections were a landslide for Hamas, and among the incoming legislators was Mariam Farahat, a mother of three, elected in Gaza. She used to be a mother of six, but three of her sons self-detonated on suicide missions against Israel. She's a household name to Palestinians, known as Omnidal, mother of the struggle, and at the rate she's getting through her kids, the struggle's all she'll be mother of. She's famous for a Hamas recruitment video in which she shows her 17-year-old son how to kill Israelis, and then tells him not to come back. It's the Hamas version of 42nd Street. You're going out there a youngster, but you've got to come back in small pieces. It may be that she stood for Parliament because she's got a yen to be junior transport minister or deputy secretary of fisheries, but it seems more likely that she and her Hamas colleagues were elected because this is who the Palestinian people are, and this is what they believe. After 60 years as UN refugees, they're now so inured, they're electing candidates on the basis of child sacrifice. When you're there, in Gaza or the West Bank, That culture of death is pervasive. You go into a convenience store, and they're affable and friendly, and you exchange some pleasantries. And over the guy's shoulder, you're looking at the martyrs of the week he's got proudly displayed on the wall. On my last visit, Palestinian schools were in the midst of a national letter-writing competition. Among the education ministry's first prize winners was 12-year-old Mahmoud Naji Khalila for this epistle to the Zionist entity. My heart has turned into a sad block of pain. One day I will buy a weapon, and I will blow away the fetters. I will propel my living, dead body into your arms. The famously moderate mullah, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the favorite imam of London Mayor Ken Livingstone, was invited to speak at the 2004 Our Children, Our Future conference, sponsored and funded by the Metropolitan Police and Britain's Department for Work and Pensions. When it comes to children and their future, Imam al-Qaradawi certainly has it all mapped out. Israelis might have nuclear bombs, but we have the children bomb, and these human bombs must continue until liberation. Thank heaven for little girls. They blow up in the most delightful way. We are not dealing with enemies like the Soviets, or terrorists like the IRA. We are a long way from the common humanity that bound those German and British soldiers at Christmas Eve 1914. Try to imagine what a jihadist feels when he looks at a Russian schoolchild, or an Israeli diner, or a British contractor, or an American pacifist. Now try to imagine how he'd feel if asked to participate in a nuclear plot and to kill vastly greater numbers of Russians and Israelis and Britons and Americans. That moment is now upon us. Or, as the Daily Telegraph in London reported in 2006, Iran's hardline spiritual leaders have issued an unprecedented new fatwa, or holy order, sanctioning the use of atomic weapons against its enemies. Well, there's a surprise. What part of no, K-N-O-W, don't we understand? In 2003, Donald Rumsfeld made a much-quoted rumination. Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, the defense secretary began, because as we know, there are known knowns, there are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns, that is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know. A lot of people jeered at Rummy. The witless twits at Britain's Plain English campaign gave him that year's award for the worst use of English. But Rumsfeld is perhaps the best speaker of plain English in English-speaking politics, and it would be a less despised profession if there were more like him. His little riff about known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns is in fact a brilliant distillation of the dangers we face. Let's take an example close to the heart of arrogant Texas cowboys. John Wayne is holed up in an old prospector's shack. He peeks over the sill and drawls, "It's quiet out there, too quiet." What he means is that he knows the things he doesn't know. He doesn't know the precise location of the bad guys, but he knows they're out there somewhere, inching through the dust, perhaps trying to get to the large cactus from behind which they can get a clean shot at him. Thus, he knows what to be on the lookout for. He is living in a world of known unknowns. But suppose while he was scanning the horizon for a black hat or the glint of a revolver, a passenger jet suddenly plowed into the shack. That would be one of Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns, something poor John Wayne didn't know he didn't know until it hit him. That's how most of the world reacted to September 11th. We didn't know this was one of the things we didn't know. For most people in the developed world, terrorism meant detonating bombs in shopping streets, railway stations, and park bandstands, killing a couple dozen, maiming another 30 tops. As Thomas Friedman wrote in the New York Times, "The failure to prevent September 11th was not a failure of intelligence or coordination. It was a failure of imagination." In other words, it was an unknown unknown. We didn't know enough to be alert for the things we didn't know. There's a legitimate disagreement about that, given Al-Qaeda's stated ambitions, given its previous targeting of the World Trade Center, given the number of young Arab men taking flight lessons in America. One can make the case that September 11th should have been unknown, unknown, one of those things we ought to have been scanning the horizon for. Friedman insists that, even if all the raw intelligence signals had been shared among the FBI, the CIA, and the White House, I'm convinced that there was no one there who would have put them all together, who would have imagined evil on the scale Osama bin Laden did. For the sake of argument, concede that. After all, the Cold War was a half century of very well-known unknowns. We didn't know the precise timing or specifics of what would happen, but we knew the rough shape, a mushroom cloud, so well that, from Dr. Strangelove on, the known unknowns generated the most numbingly homogeneous body of predictive fiction ever seen. It's trickier now. This is an age of unknown unknowns. If you've ever been at an airport counter buying a ticket when the computer goes down and the clerk explains that he can't do anything until the system's back up, you'll know that blank look on his face as he sits and waits and sits and waits, an able-bodied man effectively disabled. It wasn't like that if you were at the desk buying your ticket in 1937. He tore the stub off the book in his cash drawer, and that was that. Today our system has a million points of vulnerability. Some of those are known unknowns. Some type of terrorist-sparked electromagnetic pulse that wipes out every bank account in the United States and Canada and crashes the financial markets. We know some of the other things we don't know. Who North Korea's been pitching its wares to, where the missing Soviet nuke materials have gone walkabout, who else has the kind of explosive socks found by Scotland Yard in 2003. But we have no real idea in what combination these states and groups and technology and footwear might impress themselves on us, or what other links in the chain there might be. And we might not know until we switch on the TV and the screen's full of smoke again. But this time, it's May 7th in Frankfurt, or February 3rd in Vancouver, or October 22nd in Dallas. Or we might not be able to switch on the TV at all, because the unknown unknown is a variation of technological catastrophe we haven't imagined. Yet what we are confronted with in Iran are known knowns, a state that's developing nuclear weapons, a state that's made repeated threats to use such weapons against a neighboring state, a state with a long track record of terrorist sponsorship, a state whose actions align with its rhetoric very precisely. What's not to know? So the question is, will they do it? And the minute you have to ask the question, you know the answer. It's the same answer to the same question. Will they go ahead and slaughter the Beslan schoolchildren? Will they decapitate the bumbling Englishman? Will they kill the Iraqi aid worker and the American Christian peacemaker? In 1993, a Hezbollah suicide bomber killed 29 people and injured hundreds more in an attack on the Israeli embassy in Argentina. The following year, the Argentine-Israel Mutual Association was bombed in Buenos Aires. Nearly 100 people died and 250 were injured, the worst massacre of Jewish civilians since the Holocaust. An Argentine court eventually issued warrants for two Iranian diplomats and two former cabinet ministers. The chief perpetrator had flown from Lebanon a few days earlier and entered Latin America through the porous tri-border region of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay. Suppose Iran had had a dirty nuke shipped to Hezbollah, or even the full-blown thing. Would it have been any less easy to get it into the country? And if a significant chunk of downtown Buenos Aires was rendered uninhabitable, what would the Argentine government do? Iran can project itself to South America effortlessly, but Argentina can't project itself to the Middle East at all. It can't nuke Tehran, and it can't attack Iran in conventional ways. So any retaliation would be down to others. Would Washington act? It depends on how clear the fingerprints were. Mutually assured destruction only works if you know who lobbed the thing your way in the first place. One reason Iran set up Hezbollah and other terrorist franchises is to have plausible deniability. Actually, it's implausible deniability, but that's good enough for the UN. So if the links back to the mullahs were just a teensy-weensy bit tenuous and murky, how eager would the United States be to reciprocate? Bush and Rumsfeld might, but an administration of a more Clinto-Powellite bent? How much pressure would there be for investigations under the auspices of the UN? Perhaps Hans Blix could come out of retirement, and we could have a 6-month dance through Security Council coalition building, with the Secretary of State making a last-minute flight to Khartoum to try to persuade Sudan to switch its vote. The Iranian version of No Dong will be able to hit not just Tel Aviv, but also Rome, Berlin, Paris, Madrid, and London. How will the European political class react? Will it stand firm against threats from Tehran? Or will it take the view that there are ways to avoid having to confront incoming Islamonukes? You might, for example, approve the spectacularly large mosque wealthy Muslims have been wanting to build in your capital city, or make certain well-connected heads of Muslim lobby groups members of a special government commission. You might appoint a minister for Islamic education to your cabinet. In other words, the Muslim bomb is likely to accelerate the Islamification of Europe, because Islamification more or less brings you under the Persian nuclear umbrella and encourages Tehran and its clients to turn their attentions elsewhere. Our word is our bomb. Men of intemperate mind never can be free. Their passions forge their fetters, wrote Edmund Burke. From the Ayatollahs to the freelance jihadists, there are, in the end, no root causes, or not ones that can be negotiated by troop withdrawals from Iraq or the flag-raising ceremony for a Palestinian state. There is only a metastasizing cancer that preys on whatever local conditions are to hand. 5 days before the slaughter in Bali in 2005, 9 Islamists were arrested in Paris for reportedly plotting to attack the metro. Must be all those French troops in Iraq, right? So much for the sterling efforts of President Chirac and his prime minister, the two chief obstructionists to Bush-Blair neocon Zionist warmongering since 2001. In the months after the Afghan campaign, France's foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, was deploring American samplisme on a daily basis, and Saddam understood from the get-go that the French veto was his best shot at torpedoing any meaningful UN action on Iraq. Yet the jihadists still blew up a French oil tanker. If you were to pick only one Western nation not to blow up the oil tankers of, the French would surely be it. But they got blown up anyway. And afterwards, a spokesman for the Islamic Army of Aden said, "We would have preferred to hit a U.S. frigate, but no problem, because they are all infidels." No problem. They are all infidels. When people make certain statements, and their acts conform to those statements, I tend to take them at their word. As Hussein Massawi, former leader of Hezbollah, neatly put it, "We are not fighting so that you will offer us something. We are fighting to eliminate you." The first choice of Islamists is to kill Americans and Jews, or best of all, an American Jew like Daniel Pearl, the late Wall Street Journal reporter. Failing that, they're happy to kill Australians, Britons, Canadians, Swedes, Germans, as they did in Bali. No problem. We are all infidels. You can be a hippy-dippy, hey-man-I-love-everybody Dutch stoner hanging out in a bar in Bali, and they'll blow you up with as much enthusiasm as if you were Dick Cheney. Back in February 2002, Robert Fisk, the veteran Middle East correspondent, that is, he's reliably wrong about practically everything, wrote a column headlined, "Please Release My Friend Daniel Pearl." It followed a familiar line. "Please release Daniel, then you'll be able to tell your story, get your message out. Taking him hostage is an own goal of the worst kind, as it ensures he won't be able to get your message out, the message being, Fiske presumed, the suffering of tens of thousands of Afghan refugees, the plight of Pakistan's millions of poor, etc." Somehow the apologists keep missing the point. The story did get out. Pearl's severed head is the message. That's why they filmed the decapitation, released it on video, circulated it through the bazaars and madrasas, and distributed it worldwide via the internet. It was a huge hit. The message got out very effectively. In our time, even the most fascistic ideologies have been canny enough to cover their darker impulses in pathetic labels. The Soviet bloc was comprised of wall-to-wall people's republics, which is the precise opposite of what they were, a stylistic audacity Orwell caught perfectly in 1984 with its Ministry of Truth, that is, official lies. But the Islamists don't even bother going through the traditional rhetorical feints. They say what they mean, and they mean what they say. And we choose to stay in ignorance. Blow up the London Underground during a G8 summit, and the world's leaders twitter about how tragic and ironic it is that this should have happened just as they're taking steps to deal with the issues, as though the terrorists are upset about poverty in Africa and global warming. Even in a great blinding flash of clarity, we can't wait to switch the lights off and go back to fumbling around on the darkling plain. A world without order eventually liberates all restraints. Even in low-level conflicts, there's no monopoly of depravity. Americans think of Northern Ireland as being the IRA versus the Brits. But it doesn't stop there. There were plenty of loyalist paramilitaries, too, groups that took the view that if the other side was blowing up their civilians, maybe a little reciprocity was in order. Islamists are foolish to assume that freelance nukes go one way. If a dirty bomb with unclear fingerprints goes off in London or Delhi, it's not necessary to wait for the government to respond. As in Ulster, there'll always be groups who think the state power is too pussy to hit back. So unlisted numbers will be dialed hither and yon, arrangements will be made, and bombs will go off in Islamabad and Riyadh and Cairo. There will be plenty of non-state actors on the non-Islamic side. In the end, the victims of the Islamist contagion will include many, many Muslims. But we surely don't need to wait for Iranian nukes, do we? The Bali bombs and Madrid bombs and London bombs have already lit up the sky. They make unavoidable the truth that Islamism is a classic armed doctrine. It exists to destroy. One day it will, on an epic scale. Chapter 8. The Unipole Apart. America versus everyone else. In the end, it will be America versus the rest of the world. Whose side will you be on? Matthew Paris, Spectator, United Kingdom, February 2nd, 2002. Can America win its long war? If you think the question's ridiculous, well, other countries are certainly asking it. Because if America can't, nobody else in the developed world can. And they'd be well advised to begin reaching their accommodations with the new realities, an Islamic Europe and a nuclear Iran being merely the warm-up acts. A good place to start any consideration is the Sunni Triangle. A few weeks after the fall of Saddam Hussein, I drove into Fallujah. What a dump! No disrespect to any Fallujans reading this. I had a late lunch in a seedy cafe full of Sunni men. Not a gal in the joint. And no Westerners except me. As in the movies, everyone stopped talking when I walked through the door, and every pair of eyes followed me as I made my way to a table. I strongly dislike that veteran foreign correspondent look, where you wander around like you've been sleeping in the back of the souk for a week. So I was wearing the same suit I'd wear in Washington or New York, from the Western imperialist aggressor line at Brooks Brothers. I had a sharp necktie I'd bought in London the week before. My cufflinks were the most stylish in the room, and also the only ones in the room. I'm not a Sunni triangulator, so there's no point pretending to be one. If you're an infidel, an agent of colonialist decadence, you might as well dress the part. So I ordered the mixed grill, which turned out to be not that mixed, just a tough old stringy chicken. My tie would have been easier to chew. The locals watched me, a few obviously surly and resentful, the rest somewhere between wary and amused. Or so it appeared. But in cultures that are as foreign to one as a just-liberated Arab dictatorship, it's hard to say for sure. Even facial expressions don't always mean what they seem. At times, my fellow diners appeared to be grinning in another language. Still, I've had worse welcomes in Berkeley, so I chewed on, and, washed down with a pitcher of coliform bacteria, the unmixed grill wasn't bad. As a parodic courtesy, mine host switched the flickering black-and-white TV from an Arabic station to the BBC, which, as usual, was full of doom and gloom about the quagmire. And I gave no further thought to Fallujah until a year later, when four American contractors working in Iraq, Scott Helvenston, Wesley Badalona, Jerry Zavko, and Michael Teague, were ambushed while driving through town. They were dragged from their vehicles, shot, burned, mutilated, and what was left was dangled from a bridge over the Euphrates, while the natives danced in the streets. The insurgents were pleased as punch, made a video of the attack, and distributed it around the world. There's not a lot to be said for the "Oh my God, that could have been me" routine. But watching the scenes on TV, I did think back to my lunch 11 months earlier and wondered about some of those inscrutable, toothy grins at the adjoining tables. Would those fellows have liked to kill me? Well, I'll bet one or two would have enjoyed giving it a go. And if they had, I'll bet three or four more would have enthusiastically beaten my corpse with their shoes. And five or six would have had no particular feelings about me one way or the other, but would have been generally supportive of the decision to kill me after the fact. And the rest might have had a few qualms, but they would have kept quiet. So why didn't they kill me? I'm not brave, and certainly not suicidally brave. And if I'd known the Sunni Triangle was the most dangerous place on Earth, I wouldn't have been there driving around on my own in some beat-up rented Nissan. But of course, Fallujah wasn't dangerous in those days. Why? Because, as Osama gloated after September 11th, when people see a strong horse and a weak horse, they go with the strong horse. And in May 2003, 4 weeks after the fall of Baghdad, the coalition forces were indisputably the strong horse. They'd removed Saddam Hussein, the self-declared new Saladin, in nothing flat. And so, even when a dainty little trotting gelding of a touring rider comes through the door, they figure he's with the strong horse crowd and act accordingly. What happened within the next year was that America ceased to be perceived as a strong horse. It was a range of factors, from the West's defeatist media to the Bush administration's wish to be seen as, so to speak, a compassionate crusader. Nice idea, but to the Arab mindset, there's no such thing. So the compassion got read by the locals not as cultural respect, but as weakness. And the quagmire-itis, diagnosed by the media from day one, suggested that a hyperpower of historically unprecedented dominance didn't have the stomach for a body count that in the course of a year added up to little more than a quiet week's internal policing for Saddam. By comparison, Some 4 million people died in the Congo in the couple of years either side of the turn of the century. And how many books or TV investigations have you seen on that subject? Before I got to Fallujah, on the deserted highway between the Jordanian border and the town of Rutba, I came across my first burnt-out tank. You'd see them periodically, a charred wreck blocking the lane or shoved over to the shoulder. With that first one, I stopped, walked around it, and pondered the fate of the men inside. Sobering. Yet, as the great strategist of armored warfare, Basil Liddell Hart, wrote, "The destruction of the enemy's armed forces is but a means, and not necessarily an inevitable or infallible one, to the attainment of the real objective." The object of war is not to destroy the enemy's tanks, but to destroy his will. As Liddell Hart put it, "Our goal in war can only be attained by the subjugation of the opposing will. All such acts as defeat in the field, propaganda, blockade, diplomacy, or attack on the centers of government and population are seen to be but means to that end." America is extremely good at destroying tanks. If you make the mistake of luring the United States into a hot war, that is, tanks, bombers, ships, etc., you'll lose very quickly. The Taliban did, and so did Saddam Hussein. That's why my lunch in Fallujah required no personal courage on my part. Just about the safest time to visit anywhere in the Muslim world is in the month after the United States has toppled its dictator. But an enemy folds when he knows he's finished. In Iraq, despite the swift fall of the Saddamites, it's not clear the enemy did know. Even during the combat phase, we were playing the compassionate crusader. The Western Peaceniks pre-war human shields operation proved to be completely superfluous, mainly because the Anglo-American forces decided to treat not just Iraqi civilians and not just Iraqi conscripts, but virtually everyone other than Saddam, Uday, and Qusay as a de facto human shield. Washington made a conscious choice to give every Iraqi the benefit of the doubt, including the fake surrenderers who ambushed the U.S. Marines at Nasiriya. The main victims of Western squeamishness in those few weeks in the spring of 2003 turned out to be not American or coalition troops, but the Iraqi civilians who, 2 years later, were providing the principal target for insurgents. It would have been better for them had more Ba'athists been killed in the initial invasion. It would have been preferable, too, if the swarm of foreign jihadi from neighboring countries had occasionally been met with the accidental bombing of certain targets on the Syrian side of the border. Wars fought under absurd degrees of self-imposed etiquette are the most difficult to win. See Korea and Vietnam. And one lesson of Germany and Japan is that it's easier to rebuild totalitarian states if they've first been completely smashed. Colin Powell famously framed Iraq in Pottery Barn terms, "You break it, you own it." But Saddam's Ba'athist apparatus and other parties concluded the opposite. We didn't have the guts to break it, therefore we didn't own it. I'm not worried about Iraq. Its political class has behaved with both amazing restraint and impressive resolve. The country won't be New Hampshire or Singapore, but it will be good enough, and, even if it dissolves into 3 separate states, better governed than any of its neighbors. That's fine if you live in Mosul or Basra, where the Iraq question is a question about Iraq. But for the rest of the world, what's at issue in the Iraq war is not the future of Iraq, but the future of America. Can the world's leading nation still lead? Or is John Kerry's Vietnam syndrome seared, as he'd say, into its bones? If so, how likely is it that America can stick out the long war? Especially if it's fought not in sudden, swift, total, devastating military campaigns, but in arenas where our military and technological advantage is peripheral, and other factors come into play. Facing a foe who has nothing but will and manpower, Do we have the strength to, in Liddell Hart's phrase, subjugate that will? The enemy was certainly impressed by the speed with which U.S. forces raced to Baghdad. But the invasion becomes a liberation, and the liberation becomes a policing operation. And the further you get from that first month of hard power, the more constrained the hyperpower becomes, the less willing to use any but a tiny proportion of his awesome might. Until, in the end, he's Gulliver, ensnared by more motivated Lilliputians. Do you remember when the statue of Saddam came down? It proved to be hollow. The Islamists think Western civilizations like that. Tough exterior, but empty inside. Protected by a layer of hard steel, the U.S. military, there's nothing underneath. Why would they get that idea? Well, from a million and one little things. Itsy-bitsy, foot of page 37 news items. None too important in itself, but cumulatively an avalanche. Take one trivial example. Just before Christmas 2003, Muslim community leaders in California applauded the decision of the Catholic high school in San Juan Capistrano to change the name of its football team from the Crusaders to the less culturally insensitive Lions. Meanwhile, 20 miles up the road in Irvine, the schedule for the Muslim Football League's New Year tournament promised to bring together some of the most exciting Muslim football teams in Orange County. The Intifada, the Mujahideen, the Saracens, and the Sword of Allah. That's the spirit. I can't wait for the California sporting calendar circa 2015. The San Diego Jihadi versus the Oakland Culturally Sensitives. The Malibu Hezbollah versus the Santa Monica Inoffensives. The Pasadena Sword of the Infidel Slayer versus the Bakersfield Self-Deprecators. The San Jose Decapitators versus the Berkeley Mutually Respectfuls. I suppose the rationale, conscious or not, behind such trivial concessions as school sports team names, is that a big, powerful, wealthy culture can afford to be generous to a weaker culture. Unfortunately, magnanimity is often seen as weakness by those on the receiving end. It's easy to be sensitive, tolerant, and multicultural. It's the default mode of the age. Yet, when you persist in being sensitive to the insensitive, tolerant of the intolerant, and impeccably multicultural about the avowedly unicultural, don't be surprised if they take it for weakness. If this is a long war, then in the long run, what is the real battlefield? The sands of Araby, or the football fields of Orange County and a thousand others? When it chose to expose the U.S. Treasury program for tracking terrorist finances, the New York Times was heavily criticized for damaging national security and responded that, au contraire, it took its responsibilities very seriously and would never reveal troop movements. But this isn't a troop movement war. In asymmetrical warfare, the troop movements are the wire transfers, getting the money from Saudi Arabia to America, not just to pull off September 11th, but to advance its cause in all manner of slyer ways. We know the jihad hasn't got anything to match the 3rd Infantry Division. But what about the other fronts? If you go to war colleges or strategic studies institutes in almost any country, they teach the importance of looking at all elements of national power. For example, from the 2004 U.S. Department of Defense Strategic Deterrence Joint Operating Concept, strategic deterrence requires a national deterrence strategy that integrates and brings to bear all elements of national power, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. Nothing unusual about that. I'd add a fifth element, judicial power, law enforcement. The difference between military power and the others is obvious. With military power, you give the orders, and somewhere at the other end, someone carries them out. With the other elements of national power, the chain of command isn't that direct. So let's consider how they're going. Military power. The United States has the most powerful armed forces on the planet. The fact that Washington's responsible for 40% of the planet's military spending pales in comparison to the really critical statistic. It's responsible for almost 80% of military research and development spending, which means the capability gap between it and everyone else widens every day. In Afghanistan, a handful of prototype robots assisted in the cave-by-cave search for Al-Qaeda nutters. If these innovations have certain snot-nosed Brit toffs pining for the dash and elan of old-school imperialism, America's enemies project their own prejudices onto them, too. The great Satan prefers antiseptic technological warfare because he can't stomach a three-figure death toll. Therefore, the trick is not to provoke him into walloping you with daisy cutters and bunker busters, but to gnaw away at him incrementally, with one or two casualties per evening news bulletin. As for America's friends, there's another paradox of the non-imperial hyperpower. The United States garrisons not remote, ramshackle colonies, but its wealthiest allies, thereby freeing them to spend their tax revenues on luxuriant welfare programs rather than on tanks and aircraft carriers, and thus further exacerbating the differences between America and the rest of the free world. Like any other form of welfare, defense welfare is a hard habit to break and damaging to the recipient. The peculiarly obnoxious character of modern Europe is a logical consequence of America's willingness to absolve it of responsibility for its own security. In 1796, George Washington wrote to Alexander Hamilton, "The nation which indulges towards another an habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest." That neatly sums up the Euro-American relationship. The United States has become a slave to its habitual, if largely misplaced, fondness for Europe, while Europe has become a slave to its habitual, if entirely irrational, hatred for America. There's a line conservatives are fond of when they're discussing welfare. What's better for a man, to give him a fish or to teach him to fish for himself? That goes double for defense welfare. So, just as the only guy in town with a tennis racket isn't going to be playing a lot of matches, the logic of America's military dominance is that both its allies and enemies have every interest to find some other form of battlefield, whether, for France, the international talking shops, or, for Islamist clerics, the suburban mosques of North America, just to name two venues where the hyperpower is far less confident. Judicial power. What about law enforcement as an element of national power? Well, in the words of the so-called 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, upon being sentenced to life imprisonment, "America, you lose." Hard to disagree. On the day Mr. Moussaoui was led out of court to begin his sentence, some pompous member of the ghastly 9/11 Commission turned up on one of the cable shows to declare proudly that jihadists around the world were marveling at the fairness of the U.S. justice system. The leisurely legal process Mr. Moussaoui enjoyed had lasted longer than America's participation in World War II. Around the world, everybody was having a grand old laugh at the U.S. justice system. Except for Saddam Hussein, who must be regretting he had the misfortune to fall into the hands of the Iraqi justice system. 9 out of 12 U.S. jurors agreed that the emotional abuse Mr. Moussaoui suffered as a child should be a mitigating factor. Saddam could claim the same, but his jury wasn't operating on the legal principles of the Oprahphonic Code. Criminal prosecution gives terrorists all the rights of criminals, including the G. Officer Krupke defense, "I'm depraved on account of I'm deprived." It's a very worn cliche to say America is over-lawyered, But the extent of that truism only becomes clear when you realize how overwhelming is our culture's reflex to cover war as just another potential miscarriage of justice story. In the Mousaoui case, the first instinct of the news shows to the verdict was to book some relative of the September 11th families and ask whether they were satisfied with the result, as if the prosecution of the war on terror is some kind of national security Megan's Law, on which they have inviolable proprietary rights. Sorry, but that's not what happened that Tuesday morning. The thousands who died were not targeted as individuals. They were killed because they were American, not because somebody in a cave far away decided to murder Mrs. Smith. Their families have a unique claim to our sympathy, and a grief we can never truly share. But they're not plaintiffs, and war isn't a suit. It's not about closure for the victims. It's about victory for the nation. Agreeing to fight the jihad with subpoenas is a declaration that you're willing to plea bargain. Instead of a Churchillian, "we will never surrender," it's more of a, "well, the judge has thrown out the mass murder charges, but the DA says we can still nail him on mail fraud." And even that may prove increasingly difficult. In 2005, the British authorities finally moved against the most famous of the country's many incendiary imams. Abu Hamza is a household name in the United Kingdom, thanks to the tabloids anointing him as Hooky. He lost his hands in an accident in Afghanistan in 1991. On trial in London for 9 counts of soliciting to murder, plus various other charges, he retained the services of a prestigious Queen's Counsel, who certainly came up with an ingenious legal strategy. Edward Fitzgerald, QC, for the defense, said that Abu Hamza's interpretation of the Quran was that it imposed an obligation on Muslims to do jihad and fight in the defense of their religion. He said that the Crown case against the former Imam of Finsbury Park Mosque was simplistic in the extreme. He added, "It is said he was preaching murder, but he was actually preaching from the Quran itself." "If the Quran permit, you must acquit?" Brilliant. To convict would be multiculturally disrespectful. If the holy book of the religion of peace recommends killing infidels, who are we to judge? SIAC, the United Kingdom's anti-terrorist court, found in 2003 that a 35-year-old Algerian male had actively assisted terrorists who have links to Al-Qaeda. But he was released from Belmarsh prison the following year because jail causes him to suffer a depressive illness. By Western standards, every Islamic terrorist is depressive. For a start, as suicide bombers, they're suicidal. What's impressive about these unassimilated Islamists is the way they pick up on our weaknesses so quickly. The legalisms, the ethnic squeamishness, the bureaucratic inertia. The courtroom evens the playing field to the enemy's advantage. Diplomatic power. What of U.S. diplomacy as an element of national power? At the dawn of the American era, after the Second World War, Washington chose not to be an active promoter of America's values, America's ideas, America's voice, but instead opted to be what Michael Mandelbaum called an Ordnungsmacht, an order maker. In the interests of economic order, the United States set up a network of international bodies, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. In the interests of geopolitical order, it created transnational institutions in which the non-imperial hegemon was so self-deprecating it artificially inflated everybody else's ideas and values and voices. In recent years, for example, I can find only one example of a senior UN figure having the guts to call a member state a totalitarian regime. It was the former Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali in 2004, and he was talking about America. The organization's more artful critics agree that, yes, the UN's in a terrible state, what with the oil for fraud and the Congolese child sex racket and the flop response to genocide in Darfur and the tsunami. But that's all the more reason why America needs to be able to build consensus for much-needed reforms. The problem with that seductive line is that most of the proposed reforms are likely to make things worse. For most of its leading members, the organization is not a reflection of geopolitical reality, but a substitute for it. The UN is no longer a latter-day Congress of Vienna, a permanent talking shop for the world's powers, but instead an alternative power in and of itself, a sort of ersatz superpower intended to counter the real one. Look at the 85 yes or no votes America made in the General Assembly in 2003. The Arab League members voted against the U.S. position 88.7% of the time. The ASEAN members voted against the U.S. position 84.5% of the time. The Islamic Conference members voted against the U.S. position